Welcome to 10 Frames Per Second, a podcast about photojournalism by photojournalists, but for everyone. With your hosts, Joe Giordano and Molly Roberts. New episodes drop every Tuesday on 10fps.net or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also catch back episodes on WLOI.org, as all episodes are recorded and produced at WLOI Loyola Radio in Maryland.
Welcome back to 10 Frames Per Second. Today, our guest is Greta Pratt. Greta Pratt is a documentary photographer, educator, and author whose works explore ideas surrounding American myth, place, and identity. She's the author of four books, including In Search of the Corn Queen, Using History, The Waivers, and 19 Lincolns. Pratt's work is included in major public and private collections and has been shown in Art in America, New York Times, Sunday Magazine, and The New Yorker. Until very recently, Pratt taught photography at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. Welcome, Greta.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Molly.
We usually like to begin at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We're located at a Jesuit university, and there are students here studying photography. So they're always curious about how you began. How did you find and fall in love with photography?
Well, I think, you know, my dad was kind of a hobby photographer. And so there were seven of us kids, and he was always taking lots of photographs of us and posing us in particular ways. So I just kind of enjoyed it. There were always cameras around. So I kind of started there, just got interested in it and started photographing my little brothers and sister. After that, I did go to school. I went to a special film school in high school called Film in the Cities in Minneapolis, where I grew up. And then after that, I went to the University of Minnesota and got my BFA in art, photography. And eventually, I went back to school and got my MFA in photography. But before that, before I went back to school, I had a kind of a long career that was a very varied career. When I first got done with my BFA in Minneapolis, I started doing some commercial work. I worked for the alternative weekly paper there, and I started working for UPI and just kind of went along like that. And then I decided to move to New York. And in New York, I scrambled to do whatever I could do to make a living, which I worked at New York Film Works in the evening, developing Kodachrome. And I was the last place that did Kodachrome and learned how to color print. And then I started working for Reuters in New York City. And I eventually became the photo bureau chief in New York City.
Wowie.
Wow, that's awesome.
Stranger things have happened.
Did you just bring a portfolio? Was this a day where you just bring a portfolio in and they're like, you can shoot for us?
No, it was really interesting because I had worked for UPI in Minneapolis, and UPI was going under, and Reuters was trying to sneak into the United States. So they were opening bureaus, and they opened one in New York, and I mean, they had nothing. And I just kind of happened to be in the right place at the right time and know the right people. And I started just freelancing there. And it turned out that I was really good at organizing things. And so when big events would happen, like the UN General Assembly, we would have to have like a crew of people. So the major bureau that they had in this country was in DC. So people would come up from DC and we would scavenge up everyone that we could find in New York that wanted to work for us. And I just started making calls, organizing things, and it turned out that I was really the best one at it. So
that was
how I got to be the boss.
Nice. Were those still analog days? Or
yes, those were analog days, developing color prints, color printing in the darkroom. Yeah, that was rough.
So at the Wire, it was analog too. You had those machines that would send out the...
Yes.
I remember those. What were those called?
Oh, I don't remember.
Not the telex machines, right?
Were they telex?
I don't remember what they were called.
Yeah, because you got the film in the office and went, talk us through. I mean, that's an excellent point. Like, can you talk? Because I teach analog photography at high school, and it's interesting. Can you talk a little bit of just quickly about the process of getting all like hundreds and hundreds of rolls of film from all over the world, and you know, and processing those, and then choosing the images, the one image that's going to run on the wire.
Yeah, right? That's fascinating.
Well, and I can't really talk about that because that was done by the Washington Bureau. Actually, everyone that was shooting, whatever city area they were in, they would develop their own film and make a print, and they would have to have access to the machine, the telex machine or whatever it was called, and then they would transmit it, and everything would get transmitted to Washington, and there they would make the choices. So, but what I was in charge of was in New York. I would oversee people developing their film, or I would develop it and make prints, and then, you know, put them on the telex machine, send it to DC, and they would run whatever.
That's wild.
How did you, this is fascinating.
He's going down the rabbit hole.
Just a little bit. I'm going in the cubby. Not really. I'm like, I won't get that in the hole. No. So when you got photos, did they do any burning and dodging? I mean, these photos had to be like right out of the camera. Good. Right. You know what I mean? Like,
burning and dodging and cropping. Yes, definitely.
So that was part of the process.
Yes, definitely.
Nice.
Not, you know, putting something into a picture that wasn't there, or emphasizing something to make it look like something wasn't there, but just your regular burning and dodging to bring in a light place or whatever was definitely acceptable.
Optimize the image.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
By the way, it's called a wire photo machine. That's what it's called. Telex is text only.
That's why we couldn't remember it.
Yes, I know. It's like a wire for the photos. I don't know what it's called.
Okay, wire photo.
Wire photo.
That's
yes,
what we're calling it from now on.
Yes.
Are you still shooting analog?
Have you gone back to analog at all? Or?
You know, I haven't. I shot analog for a long time until digital became available. I still continued to shoot analog because I now shoot medium format, and it took a while for an affordable medium format digital camera to become available.
Yes. Which one do you consider affordable? Not the
whole. Well, it used to be like $20,000 you were looking at. And I think when it
was 18.
What was the first camera I had? A Pentax. And I think it was about $10,000. And so that was.
That's it?
That's a big investment. Pentax.
Less than my car.
I mean, this is also rabbit hole stuff, but I think I saw that there's a Hasselblad digital back now for like $6,000 or something.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
I might have to save up my money for that. So much of your work's motivated by American history. Tell us why you find that so fascinating.
Well, I'm not a historian. I never studied history. But when I was a kid, we used to go on driving vacations, and we would drive across the Midwest and stop at historical markers. My father was an educator, so he was always trying to educate us kids. So he would stop and we would read about what had happened in this particular place, which is always fascinating. But then when I got older, I started to think, well, wait a minute, who wrote all of this? And whose opinion about this is this? Whose idea of truth is this? And I was working on my first book, In Search of the Corn Queen, where I traveled all through the Midwest photographing county fairs and rural festivals. And I photographed this festival in Stickney, South Dakota. And it was the 100th anniversary of Stickney. And they performed, you know, just the regular people from the town performed the history of that area, the Chamberlain County or something, out on the prairie. They had white people dressed as Indians. They had white people dressed as Civil War soldiers.
Those are the good old days. Everybody was ridiculous about history. Cringy.
And I just started thinking, well, what is this? Who wrote this? Who wrote history? And so that kind of got me onto that track, which kind of became my track of life in many ways. It's a subject that continues to fascinate me. And it's a subject that keeps changing. And there's always something new to be explored. So that's kind of how it came about, was that Stickney Centennial.
That's so funny. Well, because it's February, we want to start with your book, 19 Lincolns. Can you tell us about that project?
Yes. The book came out in 2020. Might have been 2021. I know it was a big mashup with the pandemic. But that project came about when I was working on my second book, Using History. I met my first Lincoln, and his name was Max Daniels. And I was with my son. I have pictures of him holding my son, who was like 11 months, and my son is screaming his head off, and Max is holding him.
It's pretty scary with that beard.
I know, it was. It was a terrible mom. Ha ha.
I doubt it.
So I met Max, and then I kept at a Civil War reenactment, and then I kept running into him in the Midwest at different reenactments, and we kind of got to be friendly. He was a funny guy and was always telling jokes. So then one day he told me about the convention, and I was like, the convention? What's the convention? And it turns out that this group that he was a member of, the Lincoln Presenters of America, I think it's called, had a convention every year in a place that had something to do with Lincoln's upbringing or someplace he had lived. So I went, and yeah, it was everything that you can imagine it to be. So I went a couple of years, and I made a couple of pictures that are in the book, Using History. One, there was a Lincoln who drove up in his RV, which he had painted like a log cabin. That was...
I remember that photo.
Really classic. Yeah. And then there's 9 Lincolns where they're all, 9 of them are sitting on a wooden fence. So then after that, that picture, 9 Lincolns, is on the back cover of Using History. And I remember just looking at it and thinking, wow, well, they all look the same, because they're all dressed in Lincoln accoutrements. So they look the same, but really when you look at their faces, they're all really different and they don't look anything like Lincoln. So I started to think of them as kind of a metaphor for the country, that we're a group of individuals that look nothing alike, but are held together by our history. Mm. Now, that has changed a lot since then, but I think that's still the history part of it has changed. But I think it's still basically true that the stories and myths that you grow up with influence you and cause you to view something in a particular way. It's the same with any kind of information, really. So I decided to go back and photograph them again. And this time I decided to do individual portraits of as many of the Lincolns as I could get. I think I probably got about 25 of them all together. There were probably 150 individuals or 200 at the convention. And I really spread the word around, but then they're all older men, and they'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, I missed it today. I just had to go back and take a nap. So I was like, okay.
Take a nap? I don't
think so. Really?
So I probably got about 25 of them and then narrowed it down to 18. And it's called 19 Lincolns because one of the photos has 2 Lincolns in it. And so then I blew them up like 24 by 30, and they hang together in a big grid. So what I wanted it to be was that you walked in and you confronted this grid. So you're not seeing any individual person necessarily focusing on them. You're focusing on the group, which then leads you to understand kind of the country.
And the unifying aspect carries through like that, too. That's cool. Well, I like that you gathered quotes from all of the Lincolns. And I know one of them said something like, Lincoln brings out the best in me or something.
Right,
like
right, what right.
What were some of the other quotes that were so crazy?
Let's see. Fun? I can read that one, actually. I have a couple of them marked here. Let's see if I can find it. Well, I'll start at the beginning. Lincoln number two, I am blind and the youngest member of the Lincoln Presenters Association. I read Braille a lot about Abraham Lincoln before I joined the presenters. I was a member of the Tulsa Boys Singer for several years and recited the Gettysburg Address several times. The first time I recited it, the boys were singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic in the background, and I was so overcome with emotion that I started to cry. It took me several moments to regain my composure and continue with the speech. When I did, the boys stopped singing and listened to the speech, and several of them started crying too. I finished the speech and then talked about what Lincoln and the United States meant to me and how Lincoln must have felt when he gave the Gettysburg Address. As I finished, the audience stood up, many of them crying also. I was proud to be able to portray this great man, my hero.
Wow. That's
awesome.
Wild.
It's
would be a great moment to have on film.
I know. It's awesome.
Yeah, really. Yeah, so they're very into it. And most of them, it seems, started it because someone told them they looked like Lincoln.
Mm. So they're all tall, thin, and kind of craggly looking.
Well, not really.
But someone told them they looked like Lincoln.
Exactly. That's the other thing, is that there's only one of them that really looks like Lincoln.
And he avoids the theater at all costs. He's like, no, I'm good, thank you. I go to Broadway.
Yeah,
thank
no
you.
Theater for me. Oh, my God. Well, I think suffice it to say there were no women or people of color who were portraying Lincoln, right?
Correct.
At least not at that time.
Not at that time. I don't know what is happening with them now. I haven't really kept in touch, but... yeah, not at that time. They do, a lot of the wives would come along, though, and portray Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd.
Mary Todd, yeah.
So they spoke to spirits and spent a lot of money. Great.
Yeah. Show earlier that, you know, Mary Todd Lincoln was really into paranormal photography. I don't know if you know that.
She basically made the ghost photographer Mumler famous with the Lincoln ghost photo. Yeah. That's
you can go back and listen to
another episode
on paranormal photography to catch up
on. I don't know if you talked to any of the reenactors, did they see like a whitewashed version of history? You know, I mean, because these people that seem to be very historical tend to be white, older men who have some sort of like idealized view of American history. You know, did any of them get into, you know, history with you, or are they just like doing it?
Well, no, they we didn't really talk about history. I mean, we could have if we wanted to, but it doesn't really interest me that much. So I don't want to get into something, facts and figures. But basically, they were all drawn to it. Maybe somebody told them they looked like Lincoln. And so they started thinking about it. They started reading about it. And they started reading about Lincoln and reading his speeches. And every one of them just became so enamored with Lincoln as a person that they felt it was their calling to enact him for school groups. That's what they do, is mainly school groups, nursing homes, different places, parades. So they were all very much into who Lincoln was and what Lincoln's ideals were and how Lincoln lived his life. I can't say that that's necessarily a whitewashed version, because they are reading from his speeches and they are all older white men. Well, one thing I learned working on using history was how much history changes. Like now, I think they're still safe because there's not that many bad things that have been brought up about Lincoln, but just about any other historical figure is really going down. Things have changed.
If you idealize racists or people who were slaveholders or whatever. That's sort of a way that our history is changing, recognizing those facts.
Exactly. Other colors of people are looking at their history and becoming involved in their history. When I first started on Using History, I couldn't find anything about African American history. Juneteenth, the holiday that we know now, I think there were like three celebrations in the United States, and that was it. Nobody knew what they were. So since that time, you know, I would say that different colors of people have become interested or become able to look at things. Like now you can't go to just about any city without having an African-American walking tour. You can go to Mount Vernon and see the slave quarters. That didn't used to exist like that.
Right. So it's sort of ignored. Yeah.
It was sort of ignored, or it was shameful to some people, I guess maybe applauded by some people. And so it was only the white male version of history that made it into the books.
Right. Our textbooks, for sure.
When we
were in school.
Exactly. But that is very different now. As you know, you can't, you know, think about history or culture or race without focusing on the different ways that people react to that today.
Yeah, there's a cool museum actually down where you are in Britain, near Richmond, the American History Museum, that focuses on the Civil War, I think, and it tells the story through three different viewpoints, which was the first time I ever saw that. And I thought, wow, that's something. That's and now I think that is sort of, that was the model for a lot of history sort of being told in a more balanced way.
Right. Exactly. You'll find that more and more these days.
Well, it's funny because Lincoln was the first victim of Photoshop. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. See, this is back to the history changing, right? So his advisors didn't think he looked presidential enough. So they took a picture of John Decatur, lopped off his head, put a picture of Lincoln on, took another picture. And first images of Lincoln that people saw was John Decatur, who was a slave owner. So,
oh my God.
It's true. Wow. Yeah, it's true. I'll post it in the show notes.
Well, I have read that he sort of had a
he was very lanky and tall, right? But yeah. I mean, but this is like manipulating history, right? Like,
that's crazy.
They feel more regal.
Presidential.
And there was this famous portrait of John Decatur.
I haven't heard that story. Yeah, though. That's very cool.
It's cool.
Right then.
But we don't have to stay on Lincoln all day, you know?
No. I want to talk about your new project a little bit that I love, which is called Jamestown is Sinking. And as I'll be the historian for a minute here, but the National Trust for Historic Preservation has named Jamestown one of the 11th most endangered historic places. And of course, it's one of America's oldest cities, oldest settlements, and it's sinking. And so how did you come to that story? And I know it's down in your neighborhood, sort of. But
it's in my neighborhood, and I started on it when the pandemic hit. I could no longer travel around the country and take pictures. I was stuck here. So I started going to this little beach area, Ocean View, that I just found delightful for finding people to photograph. It's a quirky little spot, and I just started going there and photographing, and just it was a really great little vacation getaway from just the worries about the pandemic. And the more and more I started thinking about it, I wanted to branch out and do what is called the Tidewater area. Tidewater is the name that is, well, the white name that is referred to this area, and the area encompasses the whole area from Norfolk, Virginia Beach, up to James, almost up to Richmond. Richmond starts a different kind of the Piedmont. So this whole area is sinking. It is very low and very dissected by water in every direction. And so there's a lot of flooding And we're the largest naval base in the world is here, which really freaked me out to find that out. And then I started to think, well, it's really weird. You know, I guess a couple of years ago, the story came out in the New York Times that Jamestown is sinking. And that really sort of cemented it for me. Because I started to think, okay, well, how did this happen? Yes, the land here is low. But this is the place where the first settlement happened, the first full-time English settlement. They came in the Chesapeake Bay. It came in from the ocean through the Chesapeake Bay up the James River. And within a year and a half, the first indigenous tribe that they ran into, and I can't think of the name of them, Passaquah, I think is the name of them. Within 2 years, they were gone, just completely obliterated. So here, the white colonizers come in, just basically start killing off the indigenous people, you know, spreading westward, taking over the land, taking over the resources, taking over everything. And now it's sinking due to basically what they did. Mm-hmm. And so it just was, you know, full circle. So with the project, then I wanted to not just photograph flooding, not photograph things that would get into the newspaper, but photograph the silent sort of way that the water just comes up without you noticing it. Okay, I guess I'll take this road instead of that road because that's all full of water. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I started looking at I've spent a lot of time at Jamestown, the Jamestown settlement, which is the tourist version of Jamestown, where they have reenactors. And then like a mile down the road is the actual site of the first Jamestown, which they're, you know, slowly uncovering. Right. Sandbags up now to prevent water from getting in. They cover up different things. And so what I wanted to do is, that's what the whole project was going to be, was not just about the flooding or the sinking, but about alluding to the people came in here and now we're sinking. Now it's over. It's done. We're going down.
I mean,
greed.
The New York Times, I think it was last week, they published a map that showed all of the areas that are sinking. Not just Jamestown. Yeah. Like, we are all sinking.
Maryland, Eastern Shore. I mean, it's all the way up to Chesapeake.
Even up New Jersey, where my son is. And, yeah, up to New York. I mean, yeah, that's a metaphor for you. We are sinking.
Definitely. So, yeah, so I just continued to work on that, finding new ways to try to show that or to fit a whole project together. I'm going to have my first solo museum show in the beginning of 2025 at the Chrysler Museum here with that work.
That's so exciting.
That was my next question.
Congratulations. Yeah, and that body of work, or at least five images out of that body of work, was recognized by the Julia Margaret Cameron Award this year.
Yes.
So congratulations about that.
Thank you.
Lots of good things on the horizon.
Does her work play into any of your work, Julia Margaret Cameron?
I have always loved her. Mm. You know, loved her work and just loved the way that she was, like this woman in a time when there were really very few women taking photographs, and criticized for her inability to focus her camera.
I'm going to say focus. I mean, what, you know, like the image of the laundry, you know, with the light coming through, it sort of reminds me a little bit of something that Julia Margaret Cameron might do, sort of the...
You both shot men from the 1860s, right? You did Darwin, you did Lincoln's, right?
Yeah. Well, there you go.
There you go.
But I mean, I'm just talking about that particular image sort of reminded me because it's sort of ethereal looking. And
did you make the costumes of every Lincoln that you photographed by hand? You know, a true winner for the award would have
been. My guess is no.
No, they were responsible for that themselves.
Yeah, I teach her in my class instead of Stieglitz. as important. Yeah, her daughters gave her, for our listeners, so she's a Victorian era photographer whose daughter, she was in her 30s, her daughters gave her a camera to, quote, keep her busy, unquote.
Yeah.
Because she was kind of a rich lady who lunches, right, going around the world. But she ended up being one of the most famous photographers in history for portraiture.
So. And so now that there's
and now there's an award. Yes, there's
an international award. That's, yeah.
Which is fantastic.
And importantly, she died penniless.
Isn't that wild?
My God.
That's wild. Yeah.
Huh? Well, what happened to her husband?
Guess who spent all the money and it wasn't her.
I hate that postscript about photographers and then they died penniless and alone. Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah. Did you know that?
Disturbing.
On a quick note, André Kertész was not even listed in the history of photography. He showed up one day with bags of his negatives and dropped them on like the front porch of MoMA. To Sarkowski, because he was all but forgotten. Yeah, he's been, if you look at early Sarkowski and what's it, Barnett Newman stuff, not Barnett Newman, you know what I'm talking about, the other photographer histories, to my husband and wife.
Essentially wrote history of photographer.
But he's not any of those. But he showed up, and of course, then he became, you know, a master. But it's really sad the way that I'm glad that she survived this long in history. You know, she could have very easily been written down.
Could have dropped off the she wrote
my students love her. I teach art students; they love her.
Well, I just watched "Grab a Hunk of Lightning," and Sarkowski plays a role in there when he's going over all of Dorothea Lange's images to make her show,
right?
Her first one person show, and she was dying. It's very moving.
She died young. She died in the 60s.
70. Right? Yeah, 70 years
old. Oh, I thought she was younger.
She looked really, I mean, I should say this, she looked a lot older.
You know why?
But she had cancer.
Because she smoked like 18 packs a day.
Oh.
Like she was
heavy. About her. Yes. Fred, on the other hand, doesn't look like she smokes at all.
Yeah. Sorry, we go off on these tangents. Gregor, I was like, are we going to do this? It's my work. I have a question, and you use a lot of quotes, and I'm just wondering, you know, what role does literature, if any, play into your work? Because I got, you know, on your website, I was going through all of your work. I know there's a lot of quotes on there, and I was wondering if, you know, literature plays into any of your projects or any of your work.
Well, I don't know about literature. Definitely current events. Because I get a lot of my ideas out of the New York Times. Literature more, historical fiction, or books about history.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And speaking of
what books, are you reading right now?
It's our last question.
It's usually.
Well, I am working through the greater oeuvre of, now I'm blanking on her name, Minnesota author, indigenous.
Louise Erdich.
Oh, right. Louise Erdich. Yes. Yeah.
So, I'm trying to cover everything that she's ever written.
That's cool. Speaking of books, and I did want to touch on this because you do have quite a lot of publications. How has the publishing industry changed? Because at the start of your career, you know, I collect photo books. Molly collects books. I have a lot of like 80s, 90s aperture books, and it seemed like everybody had a photo book back then because they had a publication like Double Take or, you know, or Old School Aperture and PDN and Lens, all these different things. Can you talk about the evolution or de-evolution of photo book publishing like in your career? Because I really love that era, that 90s era of aperture books. They were big, they were hardcover. Everybody got a hardcover, you know, gorgeous printing. And then, of course,
was it just so much less expensive to publish in those days?
That's what I'm asking. So now you have, you know, Eugene Richards on Kickstarter, you know, things like that. So can you talk a little bit about the publishing side of your work?
Yes, I've been really, really lucky with books. My first book, In Search of the Corn Queen, somebody put me in touch with, I know who it was, the photographer Tom Arndt, put me in touch with Steve Dietz, who was working then. He was a curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of American Art. And he was starting a, he was going to do 5 books or so called The American Scene. They were all published under that. And invitation to come and visit him in DC. So I packed up, I probably brought like 3 or 4 boxes of 8x10s. And he sat at his desk and he looked through all of them. And then he looked up at me and he said, you know, I was prepared to say no. He goes, but after looking through this, I think I'll say yes. And Cool. Yeah, so that was amazing. And so now that was the Smithsonian. So it was a completely different thing than Aperture. I haven't had a book published by Aperture. My next book, again, I was so lucky. In Search of the Corn Queen was published by the National Museum, and also by, it was co-published by DAP, Distributed Art Publishers, which mainly, they don't really publish, they're mainly more of a distributor.
Right. Was that an arrangement that they had made at Smithsonian just to get the books out, or?
I don't know. No, I don't really know. But when, you know, I got to be friendly with the people at DAP, and so when I had the next book ready, like I'm a person that it's got to be done. You know, the book has got to be done. If I have an idea for something, I'm going to go through and I'm going to work on that idea, no matter how long it takes, till it's done, before I'm going to really show it to anybody, because it takes me a long time to figure out what it is that I'm trying to say and what I'm doing and to do it. And so with the second book, I had actually gone back to school because I was like, I can't figure this out.
Where did you end up going for grad school?
I went to State University of New York at New Paltz. And for about 5 years, they had this special MFA program that was called Intermedia Design. And it was supposed to be a cross between graphic design and photography, really focusing on books. Clifton Metter, who was my main advisor and mentor from that experience, is a book artist. And, you know, I had just about the whole thing finished, but I had no idea how to put it together. Because the first book, I didn't have any idea how to put it together, but we just sort of put it together. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter, because all the Corn Queen images are, you know, they all work singly and they work together as a group, but they don't have to be in any particular order. And there isn't anything in particular that they're trying to tell. But with using history, because of how history changes and how loaded history is, I knew that I needed some help with putting it together, because looking at the pictures, a lot of them are just really funny, but I didn't want it to be funny because it's such an important topic. The funny is good because it gets people into it. And then but it had to make sense in the way that the images were juxtaposed to bring out a third idea. Like you have one idea with one picture, another idea with another picture, and you put the two of them together and you make a completely new idea. So you have to be really careful about what it is that you're saying. And I wasn't really versed in that. So when I went back to school, I focused, you know, my second year on putting that book together. And then when I had it done, I had made a handmade, you know, cut and paste. I made a dummy and I took it to DAP and showed it to them. And they said, well, we're going to just, we don't publish, but we're going to hang on to this and show it to Gerhard Steidel. And I was like, oh, okay. Ooh. Who's Gerhard Steidel? Well, this was a while ago. He was just getting known. And so Gerhard Steidel came to town and they gave him the book. And about 2 months later, I had a fax machine in the corner of my bedroom. And my friend said, wow, there's a fax on the fax machine. You know, it was like never used faxes anymore. And it was from Gerhard Steidel. And he said, Miss Pratt, if you're still willing, I would like to publish your book.
How amazing.
That's awesome.
Wow, what a great, yeah.
So my follow-up question is, can you introduce me to Gerhard.
He's publishing Devin's book this year.
Devin Allen's book's published by Steidl.
Wow.
Yeah, it's probably the Gordon Clark Foundation.
He is a star.
We have a friend photographer here who's really big, and he's being published by Steidl. His books, he's a Gordon Parks fellow, so his work through Gordon Parks Foundation will be published by Steidl.
Yeah, Devin Allen, he's a Baltimore.
Yeah, they did Andy Lawson's book, I think, Steidl. Mm-hmm. They work with the foundation on the, or no, LaToya Ruby Frazier's book.
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful book as well.
Yeah. I love her. That's pretty cool. Well, that's awesome.
Yeah. And,
so what about now? A lot of the greats, yourself included in that category, are turning to GoFundMe, Kickstarter. And when I mean greats, I mean like Larry Towel and Eugene Richards and Ian Barry. Not exactly nobody's, who are trying to book out.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit, and of course with you teaching, can you tell us a little bit about, just your thoughts on like modern publishing? Now it's no longer fax machines and luck, right?
Right, exactly. Well, it's not just luck, because it was a lot of hard work that
I meant in general, not like
I don't know that much about it, because I got stuck working on I've been working on this project called A Glimpse of Something Shining, which is about the West, but kind of more about, similarly to Jamestown is Sinking, about how we kind of went in there and destroyed this whole rest of the country. I ended up with the fires in California. And I've been working on that for about 12 years. So I haven't had any reason to show it to anybody yet. Now, of course, I would go to Steidl, but I don't know, that's, so I could definitely be on Kickstarter. I think that Aperture has always charged people, as far as I know, for the books. So it's always been a situation where you had to raise money however you could. And that's why, people are on Kickstarter these days, people who are well-known, people who have established careers, because no one can afford to just publish the books. They're so expensive, and it's not like there is a huge audience for them, like a work of contemporary fiction, say.
University presses, I think, are sort of an interesting idea, especially if you were dealing with history, that could be a possibility. But what about Peanut Press, the one who published 19 Lincolns? Is that, it seems like they have a different model. Every publisher has a different model.
They were able to raise the money to pay for it, the books themselves. How they did that, I don't know. But the part that I'm in is called the Peanut Portfolios. So it's, I think there's maybe 19, 20 pages in each book. They're all the same, based on a formula, the same cover, same amount of pages. So similar to my first book, In Search of the Corn Queen, that it was based on making a group of books that were going to all be under the same title. So I
guess it makes it a little less expensive to publish it too, if you have sort of a template that you repeat, like in that case, the portfolio template. That's interesting. I didn't know that. So I think that's kind of cool.
Exactly. And I
amazing
think
that you didn't have to pay for the printing. Woohoo.
Yeah. I mean, most small presses, they don't, like mine were in pre-order. Like I haven't paid
but
for
like
any.
But like Daylight charges.
Yeah. So there's Ghost Books. Like that's Ghost charges like $25,000.
$30,000 to $50,000.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to put their name on the book like that. So I guess if you're listening, small press or GoFundMe or Kickstarter, that's the way to go. At least as long as you get your photos out there, that's all that matters. Right.
Yeah, I mean, for some people, it's not finished until it's a book, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it sounds like that's the way it works with you, Greta.
Pretty much, yeah. I don't know if the Jamestown is Sinking, if that will be a book, or my two, main books, Using History and In Search of the Corn Queen, are both about 64 images. With Jamestown is sinking, you know, I might consider doing something with just like 40 images.
Mm-hmm.
So far, the main thing that's coming out of that is the exhibition. So we'll see if something like a catalog can be published in conjunction with that. Would be
yes, at the Chrysler awesome. Chrysler yeah. Museum, right?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
Publish it on really thin papers. Every time you touch the paper, it deteriorates more. Like Jamestown, right? Like they get a real feel for Jamestown that deteriorates.
Or maybe it's coated in plastic and then it's in a box with water.
Yeah. Well, Louis Palud did that with his art. He did it with his Arctic prints, right? Did you talk to him?
Yes, yeah, I saw that show, yeah. Louis, right?
Yeah, we have
in ice. Yeah,
a photojournalist who took big pictures of a lot of people in the Arctic and then put them in big blocks of ice and just let the ice melt naturally in a container.
Wow. Yeah, that was Louis Palud, Greta.
That's such a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll have to figure out what so your medium.
So your reception should be people and waiters. We should all go out into the bay, into the sound, and have champagne and stuff for your opening. Just go out into the bay up to our knees in water.
Waiters provided.
Yeah, the waiters provided.
Joe, did you?
Well, you wanted to ask about teaching, right?
Oh,
technologies
yeah.
And
so I know you just stopped teaching after 17 years at Old Dominion University, and that's a significant amount of time to devote to teaching. And I just wondered, did you find it more challenging as the technology changed and as sort of like the opportunities for students after they graduate changed? What's your takeaway from those 17 years briefly?
Yeah, well, when I first came here to, you know, I taught at ICP for a couple of years, and I taught at a Ramapo College in New Jersey as an adjunct status. So when I came here, this was my first full-time job. It was digital. Okay, I had not done digital. So yes, it was really hard. First couple of years here were
staying a step ahead of the students.
Totally. Exactly. That's what I was
doing.
And luckily they didn't know anything about digital either back then. So but now it became really easy. And another reason that I do not shoot film anymore is that, you know, I spent so much time in the darkroom working for Reuters. I worked for Aperture for a while, printing like dummies.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't really need to be in the darkroom anymore. So personally, mm-hmm. I was really glad to be out of the darkroom. Too many years having my hands in chemicals, and especially those color ones.
Yeah, I would not stick my hand in color.
No.
We don't do color at my school.
Absolutely.
We do black and white only.
Not. But so you don't miss the magic of the darkroom.
You don't miss the smell of the black and white darkroom.
Smell.
I do. I didn't realize I missed it till I started teaching again, and then it was just like, wow.
Yeah. I sort of have a draw. I'm drawn back to the darkroom, but I
grew a beard. I have a pipe now, you know, so when I'm in there. I play classical music really loud and ignore my family. It's great.
You might die penniless and alone if you keep
it. As long as I'm in the dark room with black fingers, that's all that matters.
Sorry, we can be.
Yeah, I think you're getting the brunt of us not being in the studio for a couple of weeks, and now we're all just like so giddy. We haven't talked to each other. I know. But so where do you think AI is going to play into? I mean, I know, but as an educator, just do you have any theories on like the real future of photography? And is it going to affect your workflow, or, you know, are you going to experiment with anything like going forward?
Yeah, you know, I'm really not interested. So I'm trying to, you know, of course you hear, see, but I don't want to have anything to do with it, basically. It doesn't interest me, and I'm just hoping that all I foresee is just a complete disastrous mess of stuff, and I don't see any way out of it, so I prefer to not touch that subject.
AI means ain't interested.
Ain't interested. Yeah. I mean, I see.
You can say, I'm total AI, ain't interested.
I see some people doing some interesting work. And I think they're like, my thought is like, they're going to be some categories that are just like,
it's
fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah. This, you know? My friend who was a Czech photographer in Prague with me, he just posted a picture of a Czech news, like New York Times magazine, but the Czech newspaper magazine.
Yeah.
Full blown AI with a credit to second not ChatGPT, because that's all text, but the big, anyway, the big AI generator has a photo credit.
I don't know what it's called.
I'm just on a blank.
Wow.
I was just curious, like, as an educator.
Doing interesting stuff, and Timothy Archibald. We'll probably do a show about AI, but we won't ask you, Greta.
Yeah,
sorry.
We won't.
Yeah, I feel like I got out in the nick of time, because I really don't want to have to deal with that. It's really frightening to me, because when I look at just, you know, how much history is manipulated now, what can be manipulated? Right. And where is any kind of truth? I don't know.
Yeah, an amazing tool for disinformation, for sure. Yeah.
On that note, thank you for coming. have a good time with all your future non-AI projects.
I'm glad you're not going to do AI, though. I mean, it's, you know, since your projects are so motivated by history, like, I think reality is
real. I mean, the Jamestown, like, you're rooted in something physical, right?
Yeah.
Whether the environment or history or something like that. Do you have any info on the openings you want to?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't have any opening or any information yet, except that it's going to be in the very beginning of 2025.
Okay. Awesome.
So excited.
We'll have you back on at the beginning, if we're still here, beginning of 2025.
We haven't sunk into
Baltimore hasn't sunk into the harbor.
I just want to thank you very much. This has been lovely.
It's been fun. Thank you.
We didn't
touch
on the waivers, but I love that project.
What?
The waivers.
Oh yeah, we didn't touch.
Yeah, but I just want. I wanted to put that in there. I wanted on record. I love that. It's a great project.
Thank you.
I think that's awesome. And that's for we'll put that link in the show notes for our listeners to check out, because it's a really unique, and we won't spoil it. We'll let the listeners experience it for themselves. But I think it's a really great project. Very smart. It's a really good project.
Thank you
for coming on, Greta.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Bye.
New episodes drop every Tuesday on 10fps.net or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also catch back episodes on WLOI.org, as all episodes are recorded and produced at WLOI Loyola Radio in Maryland.